Okay, here we go.
Welcome to the Blue and Orange Nation Talking Mets podcast. This is Vinny. I'm here with my co-host, Mike. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening. How are we doing there, Vinny?
We're doing very well. We're doing very well. And here we sit. It is September 3rd. The Mets are off, so we will be trying to fill in your all things Mets needs with our show tonight. We got a good show. We want to catch up on where we are, especially since our last show. And talk about what's transpired and what things look like heading down the home stretch, which is where we really are. We're going to have our very special guest, Greg Prince, join us, who always does a great job, great guy. He'll be on in a few minutes to talk to us. But Mike, I guess the best place to start would be to talk about what has transpired since our last show. Now, our last show was August 6th, and on August 6th, the Mets stood three games ahead of the Nationals, and we talked about, you know, we had recapped the amazing week that was between the trade deadline and that date, and we said, okay, well, what's going to happen? And you, I have to give credit where credit's due. There's going to be a lot of that on this show, Michael. Not that we're going to be patting everybody on the back. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we do have to give credit where credit is due. And you very confidently said, we're going to be ahead. We're going to be ahead over five games. It's going to be, you know, we're on a roll. And you were very optimistic. And here we stand, September 3rd, and you were pretty on point because they have a 6.5-game lead. The Nationals play tonight. If it will be either 6 or 7 by the end of tonight. And in the middle of the second inning, the Nationals lead the Braves 2-1, just to keep that out there. But regardless of what happens in that game, they will have at least a 6-game lead. Things have gone very, very well since our last show, Mike. You were right on the money.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I'm gonna be upfront about it all too, which is when we made our predictions at the beginning of the season, I predicted that the team would be over 500, just a little bit over 500 at the All-Star break, and I think, you know, I was right. But then I also predicted that our front office and ownership would not step up the plate, that we would do nothing pretty much of any, you know, real transactions at the deadline, and that then we would have a lot of problems. That was my prediction at the beginning of the year, and I couldn't be more wrong. And we addressed, you know, that was addressed somewhat on August 6th.
Now, Mike,
once we made these moves, I looked at the team, and that's why I know I sounded like, wow, he's really, you know, excited. But hey, I mean, look at the team. It's not the same team.
No, and look, Mike, when you made those statements about, you know, thinking that they would stand pat or do very, very little at the deadline, you were using the old, you know, financial analyst disclaimer of, you know, past performance.
Right.
So, and look, based on past performance, we would have never thought that there would have been the level of activity that took place prior to our last show. And what's amazing, Mike, is since our last show, since August 6th, Sandy's made three more trades. There was the Eric O'Flaherty trade. There was the Eric Young Jr. trade. And
well,
then
Eric O'Flaherty is that, you know, when you know, if anybody's ever rolled dice, you got to know when to walk away from the table.
Exactly. And probably most importantly, the most recent deal, the Addison Reed deal. And even that, look, are any of those three guys, you know, marquee names? Absolutely not. Although I would argue Addison Reed can have a major role down the stretch. We can get to that in a couple of minutes. But it's an indicator that Sandy Alderson and the front office has operated very differently in the last, you know, 6 weeks than they have at any other time during their Mets tenure. That shows something. And it shows that they're more all in than, you know, maybe they let on. They really believe that this can be a really big year for them. And I'm sure this is not the time to do it, but it's also hopefully an indicator of what will happen in this offseason, because I thoroughly want to enjoy September and October, but at some point we're going to have to talk about mid-November, and this off season is going to be critical for this team, but that's not a tonight discussion. So there was the transactions at the deadline. There have been transactions post deadline, and essentially the Mets have, other than a couple of very small blips, a couple of series that they didn't win in this past month, they've really put their foot down, and they've beaten the teams they're supposed to beat, especially the Phillies. I mean, they have crushed the Phillies this year. And they've really turned into a very, very different team than they were July 25th, let's say, I guess prior to the night that they brought up Conforto and made the trade for Uribe and Johnson. The team on the field today, Mike, doesn't resemble that team at all, not just in terms of offense, but the confidence, the energy, the way the fans treat this team. It's amazing, Mike. I don't know if I've ever seen a mid-season turnaround like this ever before in my years watching the Mets.
The closest I can come is, you know, we know 73 had a real big fork in the road. But that was a little different. That wasn't transaction-based. It was more the team got hot and some guys who were injured came back. And I wanted to discuss that for a second, too. I mean, look, you know, hey, I'm a Mets fan, and all the good luck. I'll take all the good luck we can get, all the good fortune we can get as well. And this is not a knock on the front office, who clearly made, you know, a lot of really solid moves. Just look at what's happened. But look, they're hot. You know, like I've been joking all along about, you know, we got to root for Sandy to pull it inside straight. I mean, he's kind of pulling it inside straight. I love the sets for this move. I mean, but come on, he's got 10 home runs already. Which is crazy. And then Wright not only comes back, but he looks great. Dono comes back. He looks great. Kadiah comes back. He looks great. You know, like if we had said on that last show that any one of the three of them was going to come back and do great, we would have been like, oh, wow, that's a big bonus. So things are just really rolling in our favor, and, you know, let it keep going. You know, I'm ready. Keep rolling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're going to get to our guest, Greg Prince, in 1 minute. But before we get there, Mike, I just to kind of close the loop right now on the recap, and I guess afterwards we could talk, and when we have Greg on, we could talk about the forward-looking. It's so funny how everything goes right to what you're saying, and you were focusing on the bringing those injured players back. There was another moment that I thought really signified what's been going on with this team, and the Mets had decided they were going to skip Matt Harvey's start in Colorado, and I think it was August 22nd or 23rd, and they were going to use Logan Verrett. And a lot of people were saying about how it's crazy, you know, you're going down the stretch, you don't want to, you know, not use Harvey, an important game, every game matters. You know, people brought up, I guess, some spot starts in 2007 or 2008 down the stretch that they said, look, that's, you know, that could have cost them one game. And then what happens? Logan Verrett comes out there and he pitches a better game than you would have reasonably expected Matt Harvey to pitch. It was another one of those moments that says, you know, everything that they're doing is going right. And it makes you think that it's their year, or at least it makes you hope that it is.
Yeah, I mean, you could put me right on the line if people think that I think skipping Harvey was crazy. I've been effusive in my praise since we started the podcast of this organization's ability to develop pitchers who come to the major leagues and are able to pitch effectively from day one. I don't know how I could not give credit to the front office for that. But they have shown no ability, and I'm not knocking them for this because I don't think anybody can do it, to keep pitchers healthy. Familia, TJ surgery. DeGrom, TJ surgery. Mass, TJ surgery. Parnell, you know, Familia. When do you want me to stop, okay? So this idea that they think they know how to stop it, well, if they know how to stop it, why don't they stop one? You know, I don't understand why they think they have the answer to this. And it kind of driving me a little crazy. As optimistic as I am, I don't know. They must be more optimistic than me. It's almost like they want to keep throwing handicaps like Washington's way. You know, we'll skip Harvey. Oh, we'll skip Syndergaard. We'll skip Harvey again. It's like, let's put the foot on the throat of these guys and end it. But as you mentioned, of course, Verrett did great. So that's just the way it's going.
I just want to say what throw out one quick thing in defense of the front office before we put Greg on, and that's, you know, while there's a lot of people gave them a lot of heat for this skipping a start for Harvey, you know, last night the Cardinals skipped the start of Michael Wacha for similar concerns. Now, granted, they are I think they're in better positions in standings wise than we are. But, you know, they're trying to do the same tricks as well. And one more, you know, positive that I will throw out is they have emphatically denied that they will pull a Washington and, you know, what they did with Steven Strasburg a couple of years back and not use any of these pitches in the postseason. You know, that all bets are off when we get there. So at least it shows that they recognize, hey, they want to try to play it cool while they can. But once they get to the postseason, you know, all bets are off. And we do have to give them some credit for that.
And I think it's industry-wide. I'm with you 100%. And I think everybody's out of their minds. You know, like the analogy when that was going on that I used to somebody is that why is it only baseball executives are out of their minds about, I don't want to sound harsh, but these players are fungible commodities. You know, I don't remember the Heat. I don't remember the Miami Heat saying we're not going to play LeBron that much in the minutes in the playoffs because we're worried about what he plays for Cleveland 5 years later. I don't get it.
No, and to be fair, and I don't want to turn this could be a very different podcast, but I don't think anybody in the NFL gives a damn about keeping anybody healthy. They really have the fungible idea of their players, but that's when we get into, you know, the NFL Talking Concussions podcast. Let's go to our special guest, Mike.
Our special guest tonight is Greg Prince. One of the great bloggers out there, him and his partner Jason Fry have the Faith and Fear and Flushing blog. Greg is also a true Met historian, has written a number of books. I mean, if you haven't read any of Greg's books on the Mets, just, you know, go on Amazon, they're out there, and start reading, because I have, and they're all excellent. And we're really happy to have him tonight, so welcome, Greg.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm happy to get you back before I somehow lost my mind and ranted any more about anything, because really, there's really nothing to complain about right now.
No, these are good times to be a Mets fan.
Yeah, these are really good times to be a Mets fan. So I think I've got only like really one even possible semi-negative question if you want to get it right out of the way, and we'll get to more fun stuff. But, you know, you got to cover the news as it's out there, so to speak. So as we do head down this stretch, for you, Greg, is there any particular worry? You know, do you have any particular worry about this team or the Nationals or anything about this? You know, we're human, something might worry you. Like, what would be the thing that would worry you the most that could go wrong?
What worries me is that the 162nd game hasn't been played and the Mets are not in first place after 162 games, because we know how that goes. But, you know, from a realistic standpoint, allowing for meteors hitting stadiums and things like that, and more mundane concerns that Lucas Duda is still not back, that Daniel Murphy had to leave a game with one of those mysterious injuries that's day-to-day, and not knowing who's going to pitch the seventh inning, as if one could pencil in the seventh inning with any certainty, and all that sort of stuff. But I think that's something that any team would be dealing with. I'm not that worried. There's very little about the composition of this team that keeps me up at night in terms of, oh God, they've got to replace this one or that one, because as you guys were talking about, they've done that job. They've done the replacing that needed to be done. The injuries that needed to be overcome have been overcome, or at least those players are back. The trades that needed to be made were made. The fine-tuning has not escaped the front office. So, you know, except for allowing for human error and, you know, the remote possibility that the Washington Nationals are suddenly going to dust themselves off and become the super team that they were predicted to be, I'm not worried.
Yeah, it's funny, Greg. I mean, I haven't been worried either. And I do find, though, that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you this question to start things off, is there is a lot of, a lot of people that were really, mentally affected by 2007 and 2008, and I see a tremendous amount of angst. And I'm with you. I mean, it's over. Yogi said it, right? It's over till it's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't book, I didn't book a day off for the parade yet. But I've got my calendar. I'm keeping my calendar open, and I'm feeling pretty good about, not a parade necessarily, but I'm looking at. I already looked up when the NLDS is and possible games, and I don't know. I mean, I'm really feeling like this team doesn't remind me team-wise, the type of team, not in quality, just type of team of those teams. The starting pitching and the pitching overall, because even the bullpen, Familiar and Clippard, are so different than the 2007 or 2008 problems. I don't see the analogy there.
Yeah, other than the name on the front of the uniform, there really aren't that many similarities, plus I suppose the overlap of a player or two. What I remember about 07 and 08 at this time of year on the cusp of the stretch drive was not feeling all that great about either one of those teams in the course of those seasons. The 07 team had been in first place most of the year, but there was something nagging about them that you never could quite shake, that they were not a particularly well-balanced team, or that there were just certain elements of it that couldn't quite get out of their own way, and that the division never should have been as close as even seven games was the high watermark margin between the Mets and the Phillies in 07, and it felt like it should have been more than that. Seven should have been where the Phillies closed the gap to at their best. And 08, that team was basically a handful of really good players having, probably the last, in some cases, prime years of their career, and a lot of journeymen. And I was just waiting for the Phillies to kind of find their footing that year, which unfortunately they did, and then there just wasn't enough left in the tank to fend off the Brewers for the wild card. But in neither one of those years did I feel that those teams were peaking in August or September. This team obviously has peaked, or is in the process of being in its peak, shall we say. I think when we look back on this season, however it ends, and however the knockwood postseason ends, we should look back on June and July, where we were all sort of giving up, and realize that the Mets were never more than 4.5 out at any given moment. It's easy to forget now because all we remember is Johnny Manel and John Mayberry and Eric Campbell quadding the starting lineup. But we were getting the great pitching, and the Nationals were not shaking us off. And it was always a race. It just seemed improbable. And then the buttons were pushed and the cards were drawn, whatever cliche you choose, and the reinforcements came in, and I look at this team now and I say, you know why this team is in first place? Because they're good, because they've got good players, and it's hard to remember what that's like, because we've gone through so many years of question mark after question mark with the occasional italic of, oh, okay, he's good. Now, pretty much everybody is a representative major league player, and then some, with, like I said, a little fine-tuning still needing to be done around the edges. So, that's, to me, is what is different from now versus the times that, still prey on the souls of Mets fans. And, to a certain degree, that's fair. I understand. Yeah, you have to kind of deal with your demons. But at some point, you also have to say, you know what? Those demons were a long time ago. This is a new band, and they are playing some beautiful music.
Yeah, and right, and look at the team for what they're worth. So, I'm with you. I'm wildly optimistic, and I'm going to try to enjoy this. I mean, we just sat through a lot of bad years, so I'm not going to I guess if it becomes one game, one game lead, I'll get a little worried because I'm human. But in the meantime, I'm kind of just like, jumping around, I'm enjoying this a lot. So let's go optimistic and talk a little bit about a potential postseason thing, Greg, because I don't know if, you know, we're going to get a chance to have you on between now and the beginning of our NLDS. So if we do make the postseason, you know, Harvey and DeGrom, they're a given for the rotation. The other, there's a lot of mix and match thoughts about the other spots. Do you have anybody you would like to see in those other two spots in a five-game series?
If things hold the way they do, and I'll keep saying if because I, mm-hmm. you know, it's not right to stir up the baseball gods otherwise. But if things hold, you know, it looks like a Mets Dodger NLDS. Certainly, the Dodgers have made their statement, and they appear to have the NL West well in hand. What I come back to where that's concerned is, okay, first, well, we don't know where the first two games are going to be. The Mets and Dodgers may pass each other a couple of times, but what I keep coming back to is Noah Syndergaard had probably his best road start of the year at Dodger Stadium. And there's, you know, a nice history of Mets who, and other pitchers for that matter, who really take to the Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm not ready to dismiss Syndergaard based on, I don't know, whether it's number of pitches that he's thrown or, you know, his splits between home and road. And I just, something about him makes me want to see him in that kind of situation. As you said, Harvey and DeGrom are locks, you know, assuming they're healthy and everything else is a little up for grabs. I'm not ready to dismiss Syndergaard. I'm not ready to coronate Mats just yet. Because mm-hmm. Mets had two starts. They've both been wonderful, including one at Dodger Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think, you know, 2, 3, 4 starts in September where we see, okay, he is healthy. The lat is taken care of. There's no lingering issues. He's not being figured out by other teams. Word isn't getting around from the scouts. I mean, you know, I think we've invested a lot into this guy. And you know what? If this were still the middle of late June, July, and I'd be fine with that, but to trust your potential postseason fate to a unproven commodity, and as wonderful as he was for two starts, it's two starts. That makes me a little nervous. I'm very interested to see what Cologne is like for the rest of September, because I think there's something there between the experience and the fact that he still can pitch that I'm not quite ready to dismiss. And if you have a strong enough bullpen, and some starter is going to be in the bullpen, and you can get 6-7 innings out of Cologne, you know, again, it can all flip in a moment's notice. That's not a bad thing to have. And Nice, to me, is just a question mark right now. And that's not just to say that he's, you know, I'm dismissing him as a question mark. Forget about him. But, you know, we've seen 3 pretty so-so starts from him, to put it kindly. But, you know, this is a guy who has, you know, worked pretty diligently, I think, for the last 8 years to be in this situation. So, you know, if I had to start it today, boy, I would consult with Dan Worthen and whoever else and leave it in their hands. But, you know, I guess the one guy who intrigues me the most is Syndergaard. I'm just not ready to just say, you know, move over Thor and make way for whoever.
Okay. Now, Vinny, I wanted to throw that one at you, too. So what do you think about the potential ways to line up for Dodger series?
You know, I just want, before I give you my opinion, I think it's really funny how when Terry Collins was asked, he said Cologne's inning of relief earlier last week was not an audition for the bullpen, that Steven Matz is not being considered for the bullpen, and that Noah Syndergaard is not being considered from the bullpen. Because all of those statements cannot be true. You know, you're not going to have a 6-man rotation in a 5-game series. Okay, so he's somebody. They just don't want to tip their hand. I think
if they could, they would.
I don't think they know. You know what? They might. But that's another discussion. But I think they don't know which way they're going to go. I think they, to Greg's point, want to really find out how good Steven Matz is, considering he was only 2 starts, even though they love him. And also, you know, I think that with the innings limit and when they were having some issues with the 7th inning, I think they probably were leaning towards saying maybe Syndergaard can be that 7th inning come in power arm guy. And I think that in some ways that would be the way I would go, if with the caveat if Mats performs this last month, maybe not those last two starts, it's unreasonable to think that he's going to have every start in September like he did those two starts. But if he pitches pretty well, I think that they'd like the idea of having him a lefty as the next guy. And then who's the fourth? I'm not quite sure. I think it depends on the series if they're going to actually even go with four. Let's see what happens with off days and things. Do you really want to use Jonathan Neese if you don't have to? If your other options is figuring out how to get an extra start out of Harvey or DeGrom? So I think a lot of it's going to depend on September performance. But if it gun to my head, I think that Colon's going to end up in the bullpen, and perhaps Syndergaard joins him if Mats performs well.
Yeah, personal opinion, I'm very intrigued, and I don't look at it as a demotion. Now, again, Mats, I'm with Greg. Mats has made two starts. It's been great, but there were two starts. So he would be continued to be evaluated. We still have a month of baseball, right? And if he pitched well, though, if he looked anything like the guy that, you know, made two starts and he made four more starts, because it would be more like three probably the way things are going, like that, then I like the idea of starting him. And I love the idea of having Syndergaard in the bullpen. I think in the playoffs, you know, we've seen it so much with these expanded playoffs, how important these shutdown bullpens become. I sat through that Pirates series, and I thought the big difference, you know, we lost all those close games, three in a row to the Pirates. It was all about bullpens. And we know we've got, you know, looks like we've got the eighth and the ninth locked up. If we could somehow lock up the seventh, you know, we could get really, really interesting in the postseason. So it's, when I think Syndergaard, it's not because I don't like the idea of starting him. I just figure, you know, ego-wise, you can't move Harvey and DeGrom, plus even I'm not that crazy, right? And he would, but he's intriguing. I mean, he'd probably throw about 102 if he was only throwing it at any time. So that idea, you know, remember what Nolan Ryan did in the bullpen in 69? Remember what Sid Fernandez did in the bullpen for us in 86? That's not necessarily in my mind, you know, a demotion. So that's one of the ways I'm leaning. But I'll finish my thought on it this way, which is the best thing to do as far as the Neese Cologne trying to decide there, Vinny, you know, forget about it. Win in three games, don't even have to worry about that. That's where I'm going with that.
I love that idea.
Excellent.
So to get back to Greg, you know, you've got, you know, one of the reasons I'm so happy to have you on in, like, these good times tonight, too, is that, you know, you have that historical perspective. You know, you can really look at things, not just what's going on now. You know, you have a little bit of it. You know, you're a real Mets historian, and you've also lived so much. I know how much you've been at the park in your life. I've heard a lot about the current atmosphere at Citi Field and how it's all of a sudden now it's crazy and it's sort of just like Shea. Do you believe that's going on now, that it's really hit like the heydays of Shea as far as the atmosphere at Citi Field?
I think it's reminiscent of Shea. I think if anything, it's sort of, you know, creating its own narrative at Citi Field. You know, Shea, and you guys know this, wasn't every single night of your life jumping and going crazy. I mean, there were plenty of morose nights with 6,000 people there, and the only thing to cheer was Metal the Mule, or you know, any even later in Shea's life, it wasn't necessarily one nonstop party. But you know, it was when the good times were revealing themselves that the place really came alive. And I think you're getting something like that at Citi Field. I think what makes it intriguing is you now have a generation of fans among those at Citi Field. I wouldn't know the percentage per se, but you know, they're probably a pretty good one, especially on weeknights where, you know, that seems to be who's in the ballpark of, you know, I don't know what the ages would be, 15, 20, who have very little, if no memory of the Mets being this good or being competitive even, you know, who've seen one playoff team maybe in their lifetime as fans. Maybe they don't even go back far enough to remember 2006, which is frightening, but, you know, quite numerically possible. So in that segment of the fandom, you have a whole pent-up emotional reservoir that is just waiting to bust open, I think. And, you know, you have the hubris of youth to go along with it. And probably to a certain degree what it was like, you know, at Shea in 1969, where, hey, for the first time we have something to cheer. Let's let it out. And, you know, that is what has surprised, I shouldn't say surprised me, because I kind of figured, I was actually having this conversation with a friend of mine at a game the night that Wilmer Flores was and wasn't traded. We were talking about if the Mets really did, you know, catch fire, what it would be like here. And I said, you know, basically what I just said to you, there are a lot of people who have been waiting for this moment, not just to get back to it, but to get to it for the first time in their lives. And,
yes.
And I get the feeling that's what I'm hearing when I'm there. I mean, I was surprised last... the last game I was at was one of the Boston games that they lost, unfortunately. But during the Colorado series, again, weeknight games, where in the past, no matter how reasonably well the Mets were playing, it was just sort of, you know, sit back and have a conversation, if you could, over the annoying public address ads and things like that between innings. And here, people were just into it. And people were, you know, cheering throughout the game and urging the team on, and when it was over and when the Mets won, people were chanting "Let's go Mets" as they were making their way down the staircases, which is something, except for very fleeting moments, I had not experienced in that ballpark. And I think kind of says once and for all that whatever the shortcomings of Citi Field, just like whatever the shortcomings of Shea might have been in some people's minds, it really comes down to how well your team is doing and how happy that makes the fans, and everything else kind of falls into place from there. But it's a much, much better atmosphere since the turn of August than it was at any time from 2009 until that moment.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, as a fan, that's what you look for. You know, to me, it's always about like a little bit of getting a little. Baseball's fun no matter what, because I'm with you. I can sit there with a friend and have a chat during a leisurely game. But there's nothing like the atmosphere, the adrenaline rush you get. You know, when you're in a packed park and it's a big game, it's a great experience, and it's what brings me back. You know, time and time again. So one more putting things in some perspective question, which is we touched, Vinny and I, at the beginning of the show about how, you know, we kind of never saw anything like this as far as the offense. You know, we know it was transaction-based this year, a lot of it. But this offense has went from, I mean, it was, you would watch games and the joke was, I mean, you know, anybody that's ever on Twitter, right, the Mets would go down 1-0, and it would be the first inning, and the big joke, everybody, oh, game over, you know, and mm-hmm. It didn't seem so fun. It didn't seem very funny, you know, to be honest. And now, like, the Phillies keep going up 5-0, and I keep saying to everybody, what makes them think that's going to be enough, you know? And then, of course, we come roaring back, and we win.
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever seen anything, can you remember anything like this? I mean, it's went from one extreme to the other on that offense.
Well, in terms of the combustibility of the offense, it's hard to remember where it's been this pronounced. I mean, they've had good offensive clubs and
mm-hmm.
certainly capable offensive clubs,
mm-hmm.
and they've gone through small stretches where suddenly they're scoring 18 runs and 14 runs on consecutive nights in Arizona
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But like this, for an extended period, again, not every single night because they haven't won every single game.
Right.
But no, I really haven't. I mean, the one season this sort of reminds me of, at least in terms of the arc and how they've taken off, is 1988, where if you recall,
okay. mm-hmm.
through, I mean,
mm-hmm.
they were already in first place, but they were, you know, being nipped at by the Pirates and to a lesser extent
mm-hmm.
the Expos, and you never
mm-hmm.
felt comfortable. And
mm-hmm.
you know, they were getting by on, you know, a Darryl Strawberry home run and really good pitching, and had a long stretch of 500 ball. And then suddenly, whether it was, you know, Mookie Wilson being put at the top of the lineup every night, or Greg Jeffries being called up, and Howard Johnson getting hot, and Kevin McReynolds getting hot, and it just carried. And the difference is I don't remember necessarily them falling behind 5-0 and roaring back, because they never fell behind 5-0, or so it seems in memory. I really don't recall. But, you know, there have been, like I said, there have been stretches like this. 1990, when shortly after Buddy Harrelson took over, they had a month and change of being unbeatable and coming from behind and doing great things. But A, all of that wore off, and B, it wasn't at this point in the season where it really and truly mattered. I mean, that 1990 club kind of ran out of gas after the All-Star break and scuffled and ultimately fell a little short. And then again, the 88 team was already in first place, and you were not surprised to see them there. They just kind of pulled away. This may be, it's hard to recognize something you've never seen before because you're so used to looking for precedent, but this may be something we've never quite seen before.
Yeah, I that's why I wanted to ask you, because, you have a great perspective on it. I always freely show my age by mentioning it. I go all the way back to 62, and I've been racking my brains. And, I mean, as far as, because it's not just that it's pretty darn good now. I mean, it was so bad, the offense, So I just, and right, we're past hot streak now. I mean, it's been going on for almost 5 weeks, and it's also past hot streak because it is transaction-based. I mean, a lot of that offensive roster was turned over. So it's the game's changing a little bit too. So you always see new things, and that's another thing that's great about the game. Every year is the chance to see maybe a year unlike any other year you've ever seen. And so
I think this is a new year indeed.
and all good. So Vinny, before we give Greg back his life. Did you have anything you wanted to add or any last questions for him?
Well, you know what I'm going to ask. In my tradition, all of our guests, putting them on the spot. I think I already know his answer, but I'm going to put him on the spot right now. Greg, on October 4th is a Sunday afternoon, game 162 versus the Nationals. Will that be the last Met game of the 2015 year or not?
It will not be.
That's it. That's all. That's what we wanted to hear. I knew you were going to say it.
And not because, to quote Casey Stengel, with whom I know Mike was intimately acquainted, they will not be playing on New Year's Day in South America, or whatever the strange quote he gave was, in 1969. I think they will have somewhere between October 4th and New Year's Day, I think they'll have at least 3 baseball games, hopefully many more.
Perfect, perfect. And I tend to agree with you, and I know Mike does as well.
Yeah, and Greg, just try to leave a night somewhere in the month of November open for us. Sometime after the parade, we would definitely like to have you on to recap the season.
I tell you what, come November, if things work out the way you described, I will be so busy just kind of going on and on about this that all you'll have to do is call me, and I will already be in mid-sentence. So I look forward to it very much.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
You too. Great spot, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Greg is just a wealth of knowledge about the team, and, it always gets such an interesting perspective.
He's right. And it is interesting to hear him. I really was caught when he mentioned about 1988 and things like that. I mean, he has such an intimate knowledge of not just Mets history, but even ebbs and flows of seasons, which I have to tell you, Mark, I mean, you and I are watching this team a long, long time as well, but I don't know if I have the recollection of the ebbs and flows in as much detail as he does, so it really is amazing. But then when he brought it up, I did remember that kind of year. But even that year, I do remember he kind of had said it, and he even alluded to it when we were talking about things like 2007, 2008. It was the kind of team that you were almost always waiting for it to catch a little bit more fire, and it showed brief flurries of greatness. And look, let's face it, this is still relatively brief, 5 weeks of it. But the stride that this team has hit in this 5 weeks is pretty amazing. And if you add on to it, if we're allowed to say, if you could split the game into components, I know that's not how it's played, and say that the pitching, even before those 5 weeks, was pretty remarkable. And you say, all right, well, if that's going to continue at any relative pace, even if the offense cools off a bit, it'd be very tough for this team to get caught.
Yeah, that's why I was very optimistic on August 6th. That's why I'm wildly optimistic now, because on August 6th we already had the 3-game lead. I'm wildly optimistic now. Again, I don't know. You know, you're throwing excellent pitches out there on a regular basis. You know, the other day we had lost that one game to the Phillies. Bullpen blew up. There was a little bit of, I don't know why we were seeing O'Flaherty again type of stuff going on. It happened. But then I looked and I'm like, yeah, but it's Harvey DeGrom the next 2 games after that. Like, how nervous am I supposed to get about that? That doesn't make me nervous.
No, it's a great point. And I'm not trying to fuel any negativity. It's just for factual purposes. I do want to let you know that the Nationals are beating the Braves 7-1. The Braves, by the way, oh, God awful. So it looks like it'll be 6 games heading into the weekend.
And I'm not expecting any help from the Braves, because I'd like to know when the Braves have ever given us any help with anything. We shouldn't expect any help from the Braves.
I guess the good news is the Mets do play the Braves, I think it's 7 more times in the month
That's
of September.
Right.
And they look pretty bad, I have to say. All right, so let's move on a couple of things, other topics that I think you'd like to discuss. You just mentioned a minute ago about that game earlier this week where the bullpen kind of blew up. And if there was a concern in this, even with this great run that they've been on since the deadline, it's been that the bullpen has had some shaky moments. If you recall when we were on last, Jairus Familia had hit a little bit of a bump in the road, so there was a little bit of concern about him. I think that's been alleviated. It's been great. But then it was really getting to the Clippard in the eighth and Familia in the ninth. It was how do we get there. If the starter has to get pulled in the seventh inning, who can pitch? The seventh inning was a problem. Look, Addison Reed, I think, has pitched maybe twice since we acquired him, so I'm not ready to say it's all over. But that's the kind of guy that should be able to solidify that. Along with some help, you can get a little bit of Gil Martin here, a little bit of some other guys filling in, you know, here and there. But you would think that he could be the guy that really does, you know, fill that spot, forgetting the postseason that we talked about with things like moving Syndergaard and stuff. What are your thoughts on Addison Reed, and does that kind of make you feel like we should be able to have that inning, that seventh inning squared away?
Yeah, you know, again, just to sort of use it as a bridge back to that previous discussion we had on both our trade deadline wrap-up show on 7/31 and on our podcast 8/6, I brought up the very fact of the one type of player who you can get post-trade deadline that usually gets through waivers, right, and doesn't cost you to farm on either dollars or prospects, et cetera, is, you know, you can get a quality reliever. And I mentioned, you know, you're not going to get a close, you know, you're not going to get Kimbrel, you know, like that.
Right.
And Reed, you know, and I remember at the time I said, I'm sorry, I don't have the list in front, you know, but Reed would be the type of guy exactly, you know, like what I was thinking. And I said I expected Sandy to do it. I mean, by that point, you had to realize, right, we're in. You know, we're going for this, right? And how much could the guy cost you in salary the rest of the year? It wasn't going to be, you know, even a Wilpon's got to be okay with that, right? It's not going to be a lot of money. It shouldn't be, you know, and I know we did give up a couple of players, but what's interesting about that is we probably gave up a little bit more than I would have said. I would have said, like, you would get them for, you know, the same type of guy you got O'Flaherty for. And the one good news I'll tell people about the O'Flaherty trade is the guy we traded is like, you know, I don't think you're ever going to have to worry about, like, tracking his major league career. So don't worry about it. You gave up a little more for Reed, but, you know, Reed is signed, like, I mean, is controllable, like, for years. It's not just, like, Now, we could keep him around if we think he's decent. He's got some controllable years ahead of him. So he's a very intriguing guy to bring in. I think he's exactly what we hopefully needed. You know, I don't think he's great. I don't think he needs to be great. So I'm intrigued by that move. I think that could be a very solid move. And, you know, you can't have enough bullpen if you have to get to the playoffs. You know, hats off to Sandy there.
Absolutely. The one thing I am a little bit surprised at, though, and you know, maybe I know this is going to come off extremely nitpicky, but O'Flaherty, I think pretty early on, it was pretty obvious that he was not the guy. I'm a little surprised, Mike, how difficult it is for them to get a lefty specialist. Maybe they didn't really try. Maybe I haven't surveyed the league enough. Maybe they aren't that many truly out there anymore. Maybe that day is kind of passing. But I would have thought one of these true lefty-on-lefty guys, they would have tried to get another one at the waiver deadline August 31st because they have to be pretty cheap, and it looked like O'Flaherty wasn't working out. Maybe they think they don't need one. Maybe they think they can use Dario Alvarez. You know, I don't know what. But that, again, that's my nitpicky. I'm a little surprised that they didn't pull the trigger and get one more true lefty-lefty guy to try to throw out there.
Yeah, I think they took the shot with O'Flaherty. You know, O'Flaherty was the shot. I mean, it didn't work. I mean, it would be the understatement of all time to say it didn't work out. He's just what I like about him is, you know, I don't like the lefty specialist. I've said that. You know, I say that all the time. I don't like it. I think there's a lot of negatives of what it does to your 25-man roster. I think it's very, very hard to get a guy that's worth the fact that he's so limited and what it does to how many times you have to use other pitchers. I think there's a lot of negatives that are not being explored about that when people just look at the guys like batting average against, which is all these other things, which is either you got to use an extra pitcher because he only pitches to one or two guys. I don't like it. And what I like about O'Flaherty is no one can ever now claim that the problem, like when Alex Torres was horrible, all I kept hearing was, oh, it's not because he's bad, it's because Terry's using him wrong, because he's not really a lefty specialist. No, he was bad. You're bad or you're good. You know, like, don't blame the manager when a guy can't pitch. Well, O'Flaherty can't get anyone out. So no one can say that he's using him wrong, because unless the idea is, I don't know what the idea would be. Like, what would be the right use?
Using him wrong would be bringing him into the game at this point. That's the wrong thing.
And I am on board with that. Terry is using him wrong.
All right, we only have a couple of minutes more, but there's one other topic that, you know, again, this we can explore at a much, much deeper level when the season is over. But I guess this is one of those topics that does get thrown around social media these days when it comes to the Mets, and that's regarding Yoenis Cespedes being not just a free agent, you know, rental. But he's a unique rental in that the Mets have to either sign him within 5 days of the end of the World Series, or they can't even re-sign him until after next season starts. I think it might be May 1st, something like that. I don't have it in front of me. And so there's a lot of discussion about, well, what should they do? Should they, you know, right now, you know, try to figure out a way to get an extension for Yoenis Cespedes? I do think this is something that should be talked about in a lot more detail when the season's over, but because people are talking about it, I think we should at least give it a couple of minutes. What are your thoughts on the Cespedes situation in this contract?
It's hard for me to put it in real context because there's so much to it, meaning, you know, if the Mets were going to operate at the Dodgers budget, we should definitely sign them. You know, if we were going to operate even at the Philly, you know, the budget the Phillies used to use, like, it's just hard for me to put those types of conversations, you know, and answer them in any good way without knowing the overall context of how they want to run the team in 2016. You know, because I think that's my long-winded way of saying I don't think they should consider it as good as he's been, unless there would be some serious adjustment upward in the budget. Because, Conforto has looked great and is reasonably priced. Kedai is under contract. Granderson's under contract. you know, something would have to give, and if they're going to stay in the, you know, in the range they're in now financially, I don't think that, I think you'd almost have to roll the dice again that you can get enough offense without a guy like that. And also what we've learned from this, and we notice buyers and sellers every year, and you have to roll the dice again that if you hang around, you might be able to get what you need at the deadline.
And I hear that. I guess I'm just going to take the opposite end, devil's advocate piece. The two things I would say is, number one, you saw what the lineup was like before you got him. Admittedly, some other things have changed as well. But what a big difference the lineup is when you have a guy like that in the middle. I think it kind of showed that the old model of let's put it together and hope and pray with a lot of, you know, pretty good hitters wasn't working. And when you got a real bopper in the middle, it changed the dynamic of the lineup tremendously. As we said earlier, perhaps the biggest transformation of the lineup we've ever seen. So that's one thing. And the other thing is they do, while you're right about the finances, you have Colon off the books. You may have Daniel Murphy off the books. That's a discussion for another night as well. And you kind of put those things together and you say, well, if you have to give Cespedes, I don't know what the number is, let's throw out a crazy number for a minute, $22 million. Those two guys, Dylan G, that we talked about coming off the book, doesn't that cover like $20 million of the $22 million? So maybe you could, forgetting the philosophy of putting all your eggs in one basket and having to have long-term payroll and what happens when he declines, in some cases, you may say, not only do we need a guy like this, but maybe we could do it within the parameters of our current financial structure. I think it's something to at least explore. I don't think it's going to happen, Mike. Don't get me wrong. I think he's going to leave as a free agent. But I do think it's something that perhaps they should think about more than I think they will.
Well, look, I'll go a little differently, a little further. I'm not ready to say what I think is going to happen yet. You know, I'll table the what I think is going to, you know, 100% happen for when the season is over. But let me be clear. You know, I know you were there the other night too. I was at that Saturday night against the Red Sox. I mean, you couldn't even walk around. 2 hours before the game, you couldn't even move. The stadium was that packed, and all I saw everywhere I looked was people spending money. I mean, everywhere I looked. I mean, they were either buying food or they were in a store, and everybody was spending money like there was no tomorrow. That's my way of saying, Fred, it's not expense, it's investment. Raise the payroll. It's good for you. So that's what I think they should do. I think they should make a few aggressive moves and add to this when this is all over. You would hope that somebody's doing the books there right now and showing them how this can all, you know, how it all works out when you spend some money on the team. The money's rolling in right now, so we shall see.
And let's, you know, just remember, sometimes, you know, it doesn't matter what they say. Usually they lie, whatever they say. They did say that if the fans started to come, then they would spend more money. They did say that. It was, we criticized
more than
them.
More than once.
And we criticized them because no other team does that in any sport. They and they didn't even do that either. If you go back to 2005, it was, okay, we need to become relevant again. The way to do that is to spend money and get people excited.
Mm-hmm.
They almost have figured out a way to get, you know, have their cake and eat it too by, you know, getting, you know, people to come first. They did get what they want, so now they're going to have to turn around and spend the money, or what are they doing here?
Again, don't want to end on a negative, so I'll table it there. But, yeah, I made my point pretty loudly already.
Okay, all right, so let's move on from that. I guess before we go, Mike, the Met of the Week, we had a little bit of a debate. There were a few people who I guess were good candidates to be Met of the Week, but I have to go with the newcomer, Addison Reed, as the Met of the Week. And it's not just because, you know, he had a couple of nice innings and because we're looking for big things from him. It was because a fan tweeted to him the other day, the day he got acquired, that said, first test as a Met, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you dislike the Nationals? And Addison Reed actually responded to this tweet, and his response was 25. Now, for him to come in and be that already fired up for the rivalry with the Nationals, you got to love it. I know the next day he said, oh, I didn't know it would be such a big deal, whatever. It doesn't matter. He said it. It was great. And you love it. You love to see a player, first of all, even engaging with the fans, but also having a moment where they kind of let their guard down and become one of the fans. I loved it.
Yeah, I have to apologize because I know also some of the people follow me on Twitter. I'm like semi-retired, at least temporarily on Twitter. I've hardly tweeted in like 5-6 weeks. Just sort of life has gotten in the way. Something had to give. Got a lot going on. So I hadn't seen the tweet, and so that's why I know I was nominating other people to you. But once you showed it to me, then that nailed it down, and I think you made a fine choice. And I'm also optimistic about, you know, Addison's ability to help bridge these innings. So, yeah, why not? Addison Reed, Met of the Week. I'm all for it.
All right, now that's basically going to wrap it up. But before we go, you know, again, because you were so successful at your, you know, Nostradamus predicting when we spoke last, our next show will probably be 2 weeks from tonight, Thursday, September 17th. That'll be the next night that the Mets are off. And also, it will be the night before the Subway Series kicks off, which should be a lot of fun. So 14 days from now, when we get to that off day on November 17th, where will the Mets be with it? You know, how will they be looking? Right now they have a 6-game lead. Will they have similar lead? Well, what's going to happen between now and then? And remember, in those 14 days, they have a 3-game series in Miami, a 3-game series at Washington, a 4-game series at Turner Field against the Braves, and then they'll have a 3-game, they'll have just finished a 3-game home series against the Florida Marlins. Where will they be at that point?
It's going to be 6 at the end of tonight.
Yeah. The Nationals are winning 10-1 in the third inning. So let's say it's 6 at the end of tonight.
2 weeks from now, we'll be up 8.
Oh, my goodness. That would be wonderful. I am hoping that your Nostradamus skills can hold on for another 14 days.
Me too.
All right. That about wraps it up. We definitely have to thank Greg Prince. Great spot, as always. And we'll have to take him up on it. You know, if there's a happy postseason recap, he definitely is a guy to get on and let him, let him crow a little bit, which he's, you know, he has earned the right to do with his Met fandom throughout the years. And before we let you go, any other parting thoughts you want to pass on, Mike?
Just one quick one, which is, we only touched on it really briefly earlier, and it is just so fantastic to see the captain, David Wright, not just back, but playing great, and that's just a wonderful thing right now.
Yeah, and you talked about how we got back. We were very, very glossed it over. But him hitting a home run, game back, his first at-bat back, his first swing back from the disabled list was another – first of all, it was an awesome moment. I actually was fortunate enough to be at Philly that evening. But – it was another one of those moments. There's a long list of them, starting with the Wilmer Flores stuff, where it's one of those moments where that's a sign that this is our year. And I really hope in this case that's bears true when the season's all said and done.
I'm with you there, and I agree with that. Again, as we said before, things are just rolling the right way. Conforto, I mentioned him a little earlier. Another example, I mean, we were like, oh, maybe, hopefully he could hit a little if we bring him up. He's hitting like he's been in the league 10 years.
You know,
I
just looked up and noticed he was batting 300. And what's really funny is because there was a little bit of a period where I was a little down on him, not long-term, Mike, just in terms of this year, because he was taking a lot of pitches. He's very tentative. And all of a sudden, boom, he's hitting line drives, he's hitting opposite field home runs. You got to love it.
Yep.
So that about wraps it up. Again, thanks again to Greg Prince for joining us. We'll be back at you on Thursday, September 17th. Hopefully, Mike will be on point. They'll have a nice 8-game lead. We'll be talking about resting guys and things like that. So let's look forward to that. And as always, let's go, Mets.